Today's the 27th of February, and who am I interviewing?
You're interviewing Diana Hayes. I'm a religious of the Sacred Heart.
Where and what year were you born?
Oh, that's a good one. I was born in 1944, and I was born out in southwestern New South Wales in the country, in a very tiny small town. Number five child of what would finally be eight.
Mm-hmm. How was it growing up in the country town? How big was the population?
The population of Ungerry, which is the small town I was born in, was about 700. It was a very tiny town. My father was in business there and the Shire president of Blanshire, which was much larger than that town. The population, yes, it was wheat farming country, and my mother was born in Sydney, and we moved from there when I was about seven, and the family history says that we moved because three sisters of one family married three brothers of the other, and she already had five daughters, so she wasn't too sure that limited scope was going to be helpful. So I spent the rest of my childhood moving from about 7 to 10 to Barrel, Cara, and then settled in Terrigal about 10, and I grew up there. I've got a theory, however, that where you're born has a very big impact, and I love the Western Plains.
What are your memories there? Visual memories.
Visual memories? Red clay, wheat fields, flat. I did go back as an adult and found some things that I thought were large hills that went over railway lines were scarcely bumps in the road, measured by seven-year-old legs and younger. Gum trees, a creek that runs the opposite way to every other creek on the Western Plains. Just, yeah, space, really. Lots of space.
And you were going to say some of your memories there?
Oh, my memories were of a lot of freedom, knowing everybody. I have a memory of a very happy childhood, where you didn't have to have lots of limits, and you could wander around and you were safe, and etc.
So at Terrigal, you went to school at Terrigal then?
Yes, I did go to school in Gosford for a short while. Gosford when I was there. I started school in the state school in Ungerry, and then the Catholic school came. So from then on, I went through a variety of Catholic parochial schools as we moved, and ditto when we got to Gosford, to Terrigal. The Catholic school was in Gosford at that stage. I did 1 year of secondary there, and then I went to boarding school, followed my sisters to Rose Bay to boarding school, and finished my schooling there as a boarder. Maybe it's part of being a large family, but I took to boarding school like a duck to water. It didn't particularly worry me. It was nice to go home for holidays. But I enjoyed it, enjoyed all the life that boarding school gave me, and I think the richness. We had a lot of extra curricular things. There was sport, of course, but there was also art galleries and history of art and music and going to concerts, and there were quite a lot of other extras that I really enjoyed. And by the time I was there, my parents lived in Terrigal, so they were much closer than they would have been for any of my sisters above me. But that was okay. It was okay. By the time my younger sister went to boarding school, she could do more weekly boarding and go home at weekends. So life changed.
So what sort of a student were you?
Not a good one. I started school at four. And I think that there was some vague, woolly idea that they would just progress me when I got to the right age. But in fact, that didn't happen. So I proceeded through school about 18 months too young for my class. Caught up with me about, in the old way, it was about the fourth year of secondary school, and I needed to repeat. By that stage, I think I'd convinced myself that I was totally dumb and not at all able to study. I still got my leaving certificate. I have a brilliant elder sister. I had a brilliant elder sister. So I think I did a lot of comparing, and I probably didn't realize I was an intelligent woman till in my 30s, maybe, when I finally did a, it was after I'd been to Sadler, actually, to teach, when I finally went and did an arts degree and realised that I could study.
Must have impacted.
It impacted a lot, and it probably took a very long time to really wear it out of myself. What the impact was, an inferiority complex when it came to intelligence, and I suppose the long-lasting effect is probably in the area of literature, and I love literature, and I have studied it on a few occasions, but I'm never confident in that area. And that's one impact. And the other impact, as a teacher and certainly as a principal, is that I worked extraordinarily hard to let no child get out of their age group, so that I still have real questions about extension of education that pushes children well beyond their maturity level. I think you can expand and increase and enrich their education without pushing them up the levels and putting them beyond where humanly their growth and their personal growth is.
We might revisit that with St. Therese and because that's important. It'd be interesting to sort of explore that a bit more.
Mm.
But just so I can be chronological.
Mm. Go
makes
for
it. Easy for editing. that point's really interesting. It's important to get your kind of, you know, philosophy around that and your lived experience around that and expertise. But I noticed that, so you talk about, let's visit when you started to be connected to God and your calling. Is that what you call it?
Yeah. I don't remember when I didn't believe in God. I was born into a very Catholic family. So did all the usual steps of sacraments, and my mother was for many years a daily mass goer, and I can remember going with her at the age of 6 and just loving the mystery and the mystique of it all. We didn't continue that as we moved. It wasn't always as accessible, and there were more children as well, but I always quite liked that. My eldest sister entered the convent when I was 9, and I suppose that was the moment when I learnt that religious were real people. I had a fair sampling of religious orders as I went through the various primary schools. They were all different orders until I went to Rose Bay, and there was something about the nuns at Rose Bay that really appealed to me, and Helen was already one of them, but they were human in a way that I hadn't met to the same degree in some of the others, which is not to criticize the others, it was just a different feeling. And I suppose you have to face the fact that I was boarding, so I saw a lot more of them than I would have any of the others. I'd always quite liked nuns. I was quite cheeky with nuns right from the age of 6. So I think there was some instinct in me that knew that nuns were people and not just some other breed of person. But my first thought of becoming a nun myself was when I was about 13, and we used to have 3-day school retreats, and somebody asked me, did I think I would? And I said no, I didn't think I would. I actually was planning to have 10 children to outdo my mother, but the thought niggled from then on. I kept it very much to myself from then on also. And went on planning my 10 children. And it was a bit of a problem. I didn't have the other half, but however, the 10 children was a good idea. I left school when I was just 16 because of that age thing, and there was a 1 year less in schooling at that time anyhow. And I went on to teachers' college, did 2 years teaching, and at that stage knew that the thought of becoming a nun was not going away. So I talked to somebody, and they suggested very wisely that I wait until I'd done a year's teaching. So I took my first teaching place, and then I had a few bargains with God, because I hadn't lived at home for the 5 years of my secondary schooling, and I wasn't living at home for the 2 years of my teacher's training either. So I told God, if he really wanted me to give, and at that stage the order was enclosed, if he really wanted me to give up all of that, I had to have 1 year living at home. And I was sent to Wyong, which was quite close to Terrigal, and I was able to live in Terrigal. And at the end of term one, was transferred to Terrigal. You can't beat God sometimes. So I thought that I better keep my side of that bargain. So I entered the following year, still wondering what on earth it was all about, still with that hang-up about not being gifted. And thought I'd give God about 6 weeks, because then it'd be out of my system. It's probably the longest 6 weeks in history. It's well over 40 years now. But it was the way it was. I still couldn't be sure. And Helen was still a nun at that stage, and she was brilliant, so it just seemed a funny combination for God. I always believe God had funny taste, so there we were. So
can you describe, I mean, just the spiritual experience, like the niggling, the 6 weeks, like...
The niggling?
In your words, from your heart.
Mm.
What, just so you're telling an audience.
Oh, it'd be hard to say, because it's really hard to identify. It's when thoughts go through your head and you just wonder if you'll do this or you'll do that or you'll do something else. Part of the thoughts for me were always, will I be a nun? And I'd skip away from it depending on my mood, or I'd allow it to be there. But it just would never go right away. Whereas I also probably had thoughts about being other things than a teacher, but they would go away when I would rethink them. But this one just never went away. It was as, yes. And it wasn't something I wanted at all. But it wasn't something that I hated so much that I prayed it wouldn't happen either. I couldn't... make sense of it, hence the 6 weeks. I thought, well, since it won't go away, I'll give it a go, but it's surely not right. So something will happen and it'll then be out of my system and I can go ahead and marry and do all those things. But it didn't happen.
How did your parents receive that, your need?
My mother was totally anti that. They already had one nun in the family anyhow. They could see that she was extraordinarily gifted, I think my mother had come to terms with that, in the sense of her extraordinary gifts were probably meant for something else. They were both man and woman of great faith. I think my father understood it a little more. My parents had an extraordinarily happy marriage. I'm not saying it was always ideal, but it was very, very happy. And that's what my mother wanted for each of us. And so I loved children. I've always loved children, and I still love children. But she thought that my love for children was much better suited to having my own. And to be perfectly and radically ridiculous, she thought I had the right hips to carry them, so that, you know, it should have been that I was obviously designed for marriage and my own children. And but my parents had brought us up to seek our own truth, and so having tried everything, they certainly weren't going to be coercive in any way. And so when I stuck to what I really felt I needed to do and tried to explain that to them, I think she actually had a niggling suspicion it would be me that would be next if anyone else went, but she didn't want it to be. So they, obviously they supported the fact that I entered, but she always had difficulty with it. My mother, my family, both my family come from Irish root, but my mother very close to the Irish. We used to call her the witch on occasions, because she had that really deep ESP with us as well. And so And I'm very like her in that sense, not to look at, but the deep ESP with people, and I had it with her. So if I did have unhappy moments, I used to make sure I wasn't thinking about her, because she would have picked it up. But she, I think she probably finally accepted it when I was coming up to final vows, about 10 years later. Even so, she would very much have liked to it for not to happen.
I'm just going to move this mic here, and we might just, because I notice you just sort of go back and forth, and it's, which is fine.
Mm.
But I just want to get that.
Okay. Is it clear enough?
Yeah, no, it's great. I just want to make sure we've really got it. Yeah, it's very clear.
Okay.
So just go back, just to cover, we'll just repeat that ESP. Oh, I don't think we, I think, just about when your mother did accept your vows.
Well, it was ESP that time, and that's the connection in my head. I was in Japan in the 3 months before I was finally professed. And the day that she accepted it and wrote me a letter to say that she accepted it, I knew. I got the letter 3 days later. So there was just that sense of... And I remember saying to the person who was directing me, my mother's accepted it at long last. I'm quite sure she'll be all right. And I got the letter 3 or 4 days later to say yes, she was okay. So that was it. It was probably somewhat complex, made more complex. Some quite number of years later when my sister left the convent again, and she was the very gifted one, and I didn't leave, and I was the lesser of the two gifted ones. And so it was just as confusing for her. That was just as confusing for her as anything else had ever been, because she only saw two choices. She only saw marriage and religious life. She didn't see anything in the middle. I remember saying to my sister, I hope there is someone for you someday if that's what you like, but for God's sake, don't you dare get married now, because I think we just need a bit of space so that she can actually realize that this is a relationship with God thing and a different way of going than just marriage or religious life. In actual fact, she never married, and I don't know whether she was ever tempted to, but anyhow, she never did, so we had to deal with it as it was.
I think I find that point really interesting too, and relevant, like so important.
Mm.
That exploring that territory in between, you know, that people think in their head. That
you have to go back a whole generation almost, and probably a couple really, because the generations have speeded up. And a lot of, there were very few single women in those days. There were some, obviously, career women, but or ones who'd stayed home to care for their parents, but they were the minority by far. So while for my generation it's fine, for my mother's generation I do actually understand that that's how she saw fulfillment, and she really wanted fulfillment for all of us. For her, really, the main fulfillment was in a sexual relationship that was loving. But she could maybe just by that stage understand there might have been another one.
Just want to wait, is that her talking upstairs? Well, I'm just going to pause it for a minute.
Okay.
Okay. So we'll explore that more a bit later.
Mm-hmm.
For some later work. So how big was the influence of your sister for you to go into the convent in all?
Probably it was a counter influence in lots of ways.
So you might want to repeat that to me, saying, you know, my sister going into the convent.
My sister going into the convent was probably a counter influence rather than an encouragement. The encouragement side would be on the fact that she was my sister and she'd become a nun when I was about 9, and therefore I knew that ordinary people became nuns. The counter-influence was exactly what I've said to you. She was really quite extraordinarily talented, and I could see that was a good gift to give to God. I could see that she was very special. I loved her very much, and I didn't see how God could have both of us when we were so different in so many ways. So On the other hand, she seemed to be quite delighted that I would be joining her in the convent. I went to see her. She was in Brisbane at the time before I entered, and she seemed quite delighted. So it was... We never actually lived together as religious, or not longer than a very short time. We did actually work together for about more like 2 years before her health broke out. She was the... When King Copple and Rose Bay amalgamated, she was the overall principal and I was the principal of the primary school, so we were on the same team of running the school.
How was your experience in your when you were a novice? Like, what were you doing?
Noviceship in those days was really, looking backwards, was really weird. Religious life was changing, and I'm inclined to think that I'm one of the bridges of that time. I had a very traditional noviceship where we had a lot of silence, and we went through the stages, 6 months and 2 years, and lots of ridiculous sort of training that we had. Part of my nature runs a bit high over that, so I didn't get too upset by it, but part of it didn't either. You become almost childlike, which is a bit silly. There's no real engagement with you as an adult, except on the faith level, trying to continue to grow into God. I enjoyed things the Mother Mistress of Novices was frightened of. I kept bees and she was allergic to them. It wasn't so very different from boarding school, in that we all did the same thing. We got up at the same time. We did the same meals. Some of the customs were monastic, and I hadn't been used to that. But I just took to them. I thought, it was that sort of, well, I'll give it 6 weeks, so I'll go along with it, and I'll see how it works. And gradually found myself not committed to the monastic things, but actually to developing a relationship with God that underpinned it, yes. So I think I put up with a lot of it. My last year in the novitiate, or the last 6 months, 8 months, was fairly hellish, because they changed the Mistress of Novices, and the person they put in was not able for the job, and I probably just survived that, probably by being extremely outspoken and telling her that I didn't think she should have the job, which was a bit crazy. It wasn't her fault that she had it, and it was, I think, an unthought through appointment. So that was a bit crazy. And then after that, I had another year of sort of studies in theology and so on, which probably cemented where I was at. Then I went to New Zealand, which... New Zealand was a very interesting thing. I had a fairly checkered time. Do you want me to go on with this?
Yes, if you'd like to.
The time in New Zealand was checkered. I went to Wellington, and I was teaching in the parish school and had a dormitory in the secondary school. It was 1968, and it was the time of huge changes. We just had a chapter in 67. Things were changing. The habit was the least of it, but the habit was changing. We didn't come out of it, but we did in those 3 years, or we started to experiment with it in those 3 years. The person who was in charge in Wellington was a sick woman, and the one who was her seconder had a mental illness. So it was a combination that was interesting. The woman with the mental illness was an Irish woman. Sorry, you might need to delete that because it might identify her.
Yeah, that's fine.
But however, I had known her at Rose Bay, and she, for some reason, took a fancy to me. So I was never able to do anything wrong with her, but nobody else was able to do any right. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit of an uncomfortable place to be.
It was an obsession or something.
She was not obsessive with me, but I could... I could walk over her washed floors, everybody else would get into trouble, that sort of thing, or if we needed to do things. It didn't go into any other further than that. She was just a strange person. Shouldn't have been in authority, I think. It's one of those things looking back, but anyhow, she was. And oh, a second. I was the only young professed in New Zealand, so I was a bit of a unique person, and I wasn't a New Zealander either. So those 3 years, I God does some funny things. I became very good friends with the parish priest, who until his death a couple of years ago I maintained a friendship of some sort with. Not a close friendship, but a very fatherly sort of friendship that provided things that couldn't come in other ways. And some of the other RSCJ in the community were just wonderful. So we found our own ways out of a strange situation. And then I came back to Australia at the end of 1970. They were times of huge change. We were all in a state of upheaval. I came back at the end of 1970 and everyone was coming out of the habit, so I came straight out of the habit into secular clothes at that time. There'd been more movement here in Australia than there had been in New Zealand. New Zealand was more conservative around some of those things. Over here they'd had a whole lot of variety of colours. We'd stayed in black and white. You know, some just interesting things. I suppose I was young enough just to take to secular clothes and the reasons for them, and without any problems. Yeah, so I spent 3 years at Barrowburn, and then I went to profession in Japan for 3 months, and then I came to Sadler. I found it extremely difficult to wear a veil at Sadler because I'd already been out of it for 3 years. I didn't find anyone else out there could understand that, because they'd been wearing, putting it on and off, putting it on and off, and they thought I was just being balmy. So I put it on, and I had great respect. The only reason I put it on probably was my respect for Father Muldoon, even then. But I just didn't see any point in it. I just felt dressed up at that stage in ways that didn't quite tally with who I was. I was there for a couple of years teaching, and then I went off to Queensland to do a degree and was again out of the habit. And when I was coming back, I thought I need to organise this. Then I was asked to come back as principal. So I need to organise this wretched veil, this thing. So I went to see Father Muldoon and I talked it through with him. He couldn't hear it. He couldn't hear anything except that he wanted his nuns in veils. And his compromise with me at the end was if I could wear them in his church and his school. And that's what I did. I wore them to Mass and I wore them in the school, and I didn't wear them at any other time. And it was only out of respect for him, really. And he was very gentle, because when finally... And Nancy Fitzgerald, when she came, tried the same thing because she just couldn't wear it. And it was finally when one of the Sisters of Charity decided that they weren't going to wear veils that he came and said to me something about the Sisters of Charity are not wearing veils. And I said, so what? And he said, well, if they don't have to wear it, I can't ask you to wear it. I said, what the Sisters of Charity do makes no difference to me whatever. I only wear the veil because you want me to wear it. So the answer, the question is, do you want me to wear the veil or don't you? He said, no, you can do what you like. So that's when we came out of the veil. But we maintained some sort of uniform, and it was a compromise as much as anything.
So just how did you get to Sadler? How did that come about?
I was asked to go there.
By who?
By the provincial. In those days we just got moved around. And so when I was in Japan I had a call from the provincial asking me would I go to Sadler as my appointment when I came back from final vows. Which I did. I just went there and I was teaching year six. It's your young sister and one of your sisters in that class. The next one, I'm not sure which. One of them. Anyhow, I had two classes. I can't remember which Michelle was in. I'm not very good with dates. I collide years a bit.
So what year did you come to Sadler?
74.
So can you just talk, just clarify a bit, so there wasn't any general rule across the board about dress?
The society had said we could wear secular dress as long as it was simple and we wore some sort of a symbol with a cross or something. Sadler of all, the only place in Australia and New Zealand, and it was only Father Muldoon asked us to wear a veil. And by that stage, I think we'd come to wearing navy and white. I think they'd worn all sorts of colours up until then. So really, as far as the society went, we didn't need to wear a habit. As far as Father Muldoon went, we did.
So moving from monastic or secular, sorry, not monastic, the secular into, what's the other word?
The habit.
Moving from an enclosed order.
Into an apostolic one.
Into an apostolic. Will we talk about that? Can you talk about that
a bit
broadly?
Yep. We were never not apostolic. We were in the Vatican councils. We hit a footnote in the Vatican II documents. We hit a footnote that said that some orders were both contemplative and apostolic, and that's we were. At the time of the Vatican then and our changes that came after that and at general chapters, we actually had to decide whether we wanted to remain contemplative or we were going to be apostolic. There was no longer a middle road. And so our life was in education, and so we chose apostolic at that stage. I have to say, we don't any longer have the monastic underpinning. We don't have the externals of the monastic, but we do still have a very, very strong contemplative side to our call. And it's very similar to some other orders who are based on the Ignatian tradition and usually comes across in the words contemplatives in action. So people who have a really strong contemplative prayer life, but who work in some sort of apostolic work that's around education for us, but whatever. So it's that the double whammy is still there, the call is still true, but we're called an apostolic order now. And so we're not bound by solemn vows in any way. We never had solemn vows, but we had a vow of stability that kept the monastic in it, and that's gone.
Mm. What are solemn vows?
Solemn vows are taken by contemplative orders like Carmelites and Four Clares and Benedictines like a Jamboree. They take solemn vows, and their vows keep them in the one place for life. We had a vow of stability that kept us in the convent and not going out and so on, but we never had the solemn vows.
Mm. How did you find the contemplative life?
I couldn't live without it.
Sorry, I'm getting confused. The life before,
the monastic life.
The monastic life, not the cottage.
I think I just took it in my stride.
We'll talk about the three, and we'll start again. So we'll talk about the monastic, the apostolic, but transition for you personally, perhaps, how it was.
Mm.
And then we'll go into the what that means to you.
Okay. The monastic life gave... The monastic externals gave us a lot of space. Everything was very regulated. And I was young enough at that stage not to be at the place that some people had a challenge who were carrying heavy responsibility as well. So it protected for you the hour's prayer in the morning, half an hour in the afternoon, time to do some spiritual reading, time to do some reflections, time to reflect on your half day and your half day, very regular sleeping hours. It was a very regulated life, the monastic side of our life. And while it had some quaint customs, it was also probably quite healthy in that sense of everything was given its due time. So at no time while we were doing that was I old enough to be like carrying a principalship or anything else that would have needed extra time to some of those things. So it was fine. By the time I went to New Zealand, things were changing. And so those were the years of exploration for me. And we started no longer to have enclosure. So I was working in a parish school, so we started to do parish visitation after school or visiting families after school, getting involved in parish evenings and choirs and such like things. So life was finding different patterns, and it was sometimes a balancing act to keep the hours, prayer in the morning and some of the other things. There were some freedoms that were coming through. There'd always been a freedom of conscience, but there were other freedoms that were coming through. If you didn't want to go to confession to the priest who came to the convent every week, you could go somewhere else. You know, there were some of those basic freedoms that were coming.
I'm going to shut that door. It's the bird. I know it's probably not as much hearing, but if you don't mind.
No, there's air coming through in other places. It's hard to get a quiet place, isn't it?
That's always tricky.
On these noisy chairs. Okay. So there were freedoms that were coming in. And they were certainly the years, they were tough years, but they were the years when I explored some of those freedoms. From then I came back to Sydney and to Rose Bay and to the primary school, and I was in fact a principal. And then it did become quite demanding. But by that stage we were beginning to be able to balance our own lives, get up earlier if you wanted to, go to bed later, get up later if you wanted to. There was a lot more freedom in our lives at that stage, and I think that suited me. And I think because I was younger, you just took the changes as they were coming through, whereas for some of the older people it was much harder. Managing secular dress, I'd only been out of it a few years, so there was no real problem with managing it, whereas some of our older sisters went through some very funny stages of putting very weird and wonderful things together. But those things I just took for granted. I think I was extremely immature in lots of ways. I went from there to probation, which is the 3 months before profession in an international group, and mine was in Japan. And I went through that and through the 30-day retreat that was part of that and through final vows and went ahead with all of that. When I came back to Sadler, as I told you, and then I went to university. And in that process, something happened to me. So after 1 year of university, life went haywire. I didn't know what had hit me. I questioned everything. I think I was just 33. I knew that I needed to do something drastic, so I withdrew from uni for 6 months and I came down here to Sydney again. I did a desk job in the library at King Copper Rose Bay a few days a week, and I got some counselling, really solid and good counselling, and wondered what the hell I was doing. And I suppose did a head dive right through the depth of myself and still found God. It was quite an interesting experience, and I can remember it as clearly as yesterday. It was Pentecost Sunday. I was desperate. I was crying. I just didn't know what had hit me. And suddenly on Pentecost Sunday, there was peace. Sudden peace. And it stayed with me all through Pentecost Sunday, and then it disappeared again. But it was enough to give me hope that I would find my way through the morass of things. And it was that moment of digging through, finding who I was myself, wondering if I should be in religious life, wondering where I'd got it all wrong, and finally growing into my adulthood, I think. And so I, 1 week I said, I'm not going back to uni. I obviously don't need to go back to uni. And the next week I made the decision to go back to uni. And I did finally go back to uni. And that probably was a very different time. So then I completed my degree gradually. I was only 6 months behind in finishing that. The 6 months I'd taken off, I finished. But I was a different person. My feet were more solidly on the ground. I had discovered that I thought I was where God wanted me to be. I had, yes, and then I went back as principal of Sadler from that space. They were wonderful years. There's a part of my soul that'll always be in Sadler. But they were wonderful years and really tough years as principal. I'd taken over from Betty McMahon, who I don't need to tell you, was such a personality in her own right, did things her own way, had set the whole thing up, and I was very different from her. We were quite good friends, but I was very different from her and knew from the very beginning that if I didn't do things my way, they weren't going to survive. It was hard for Father Muldoon. He liked Betty's ways most of the time. He didn't like the way she managed money, but he liked everything else. I think his words were, better the devil you know than the one you don't, or some such helpful thing. Anyhow, we had a good working relationship, but he did check most of the things I offered to do past Betty, which was fairly insulting and tough. I recognized his need to do it. She was great, but they were tough years in that sense. But I'd have to say he always supported me through the difficult decisions. He wouldn't do them, but he would support and he'd listen. I discovered a bit of a workaholic in myself, I think, and Sadler can leave you a bit vulnerable to that, the whole Green Valley area, with all the needs of families and outside just the strict running of a school. And by the end of that time, 1984, I finished up there. 1984 also, my mother died. And I had nursed her, taken off a bit of time and nursed her. By the end of 84, I was pretty close to burnout. So I went, I took a year off, not out of the order, but off from doing much. Got some help again, took some time out to just relax and be. Started a bit of a desk job just to, I suppose, earn my keep and keep me a bit stabilized. And came good, probably by the end of the year. I also had surgery early that year, so I think the whole combination was there. Then.
So just taking you back to your first, thank you for that, your first snippet of Green Valley was in 74, is that correct? So you actually, in 74 you had a snippet and then you went back to...
74, 75 I taught. Betty was the principal. I taught you six, so that was the snippet, yes.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about your first impressions on arriving and maybe, you know, literally some visual, you know, what happened when you arrived and what did you think?
I arrived a bit late for the school year because I came from profession on the 3rd of February in Japan, and I went into year six after about a week. I was very glad to be back in a classroom, but the children of Green Valley and Sadler are nothing if not somewhat wary, and there was a bit of a standoff for a while, and it finally came out of one person's mouth that said, "Gee, you talk posh," and I said, "Well, I actually can't help the way I talk, but can we just get on with it?" So we did get on with it, and I remember several times going to Betty and saying, "They don't like me, it's very difficult, I've got this lack of relationship, we're talking through glass things, are you sure this is right?" She said, "Look, it takes 6 months." I said, "Fine." So for 6 months I battled on with my young friends, and after 6 months the same mouth said, "You're okay, even though you talk posh." And from that moment, I have never felt anything but at home in Green Valley. There's something twisted inside of me. I'd never thought that I didn't belong there, but I just, if people can't relate with you, I'm very relational. If the kids couldn't relate with me, then I may not have been the right one for them. That was my feeling. However, after that, I appeared to be the right one for them. And so, or a one that they could manage. So that's Green Valley. The actual externals of Green Valley were fine. I certainly it was a housing commission estate, but I'd lived a very checkered life. I wasn't used to. Rose Bay was not my milieu. I'd lived in the country. Sure, my family was big and we'd had a bigger house maybe than some people, but when we moved to Terrigal, we were not very wealthy at all, and we lived in not squalid, but things that were very simple and not the best that they could be. So that was it just was fine for me. It didn't impact in that way. What impacted to me was the lack of services, the lack of entertainment for young people, the all the things that Frank Scantry actually put in How Green Was My Valley, I think, and which I've fought for quite a number of times since then when they open up new areas, to not wait and to see what people want, but to get some services, some shops, some picture theatres, some skating rinks, some sort of entertainment for the people when you transfer them from somewhere else. I think they're still making all the same mistakes, but anyhow, they did in Green Valley. By the time I got to Green Valley, some trees were beginning to grow as well, and I needed, sorry, Inez?
I'll just pause, that's all right.
So am I.
Yeah, I think you just...
I think the services and services. Stuff, yeah.
So what was your impression of... Can you describe the people? What did the community give you? Well, like, what did the children give you was in terms of this transfer?
I think once the children accepted me, they gave me probably the best gift any teacher in life could have, which is acceptance. Of course, you finish up in a different relationship with them, but they... That struggle to move towards acceptance was a really good journey for me, because once they accepted me, it was fine. Their parents had always accepted. I fitted into the pattern of the community. I wasn't the only one who talked posh as far as the community went. I was stunned to find that some of the parents in the class that I was teaching were the same age as I was. And I wasn't accustomed really to people having children at 18. And so that was good learning. It was really nice to meet parents of my own age group, but it was a bit of a shock at that year six level. Or maybe I just needed to learn I was getting older. I think it was the earthiness and the struggle, the acceptance, the tolerance, the people who are really working to bring their children up well within a situation that was somewhat difficult for them, the people who'd been upended from where they were accustomed to living and suddenly on this outskirts, and just taking that, glad to have their homes, but glad, not so glad to be struggling to find what worked for them. It was still pretty early days by the time I got there in 74. So they'd found a lot of their own answers, but there were still people working that through. What I did find was a whole community who were really incredibly supportive of each other, and they just absorbed me into it. Betty was still there those years, if you remember, so it was just an absorption into that whole life, of bingo, and the church was built by the time I got there, so I didn't have the early stage of clearing those things out, but the school was still on both sides of the road when I was there. And so, in fact, it was when I came back, I actually was there to move that back across the road. So there were all those inconveniences that people took for granted, and I think he just became very realistic, very aware of people, very, yeah. all of the above. The convent was comfortable, so we, it was a good time.
How was the convent, living in the convent?
It was fine. There was enough space for us. In living in religious life, you do need a bit of space. And there's plenty of space. You've been in the convent, it's around the square. There was a lot of inside space. Betty was a dominant person, but she was a very benign one. So that was, that worked. She was in charge. And that worked for all of us, I think. Yeah.
How did you fit in? And who did you forge any lifelong sort of friendships?
I was already a lifelong.
I
was already a lifelong friend with Joy Belt. We'd taught together in New Zealand, so that probably helped. I think I just got on with most of them. I don't remember anybody in particular. I'm sure we had a few over the period of that time who were sort of isolates and doing things differently. But on the whole, no, they didn't tend to survive at Sadler because you had to buck in and be part of things, really. So I think that's fine. We did some crazy things, like taking away adolescents for camps, and nowadays they make me feel weak. But we did them anyhow. I've got some lovely memories of borrowing a bus from the Spastic Centre or somebody like that to take away a group of kids, which was fine, but they spent their whole time talking to people outside the bus and going into spasms, trying to say to them, I know there's Spastic Centre on the bus, but really you don't need to take off spastic people. But they were just, again, it was that earthy, the rough side of Golden Interiors, I think. Chasing kids at school camps. Maybe I'll get a place in heaven one day.
So, when you, you mustn't be too stupid if they've asked you to be the principal of the school. So.
Oh no, I had discovered that I was not stupid by then. By the time I was principal, I discovered that. In fact, I think I probably discovered that I was highly intelligent. But it just, what I also learned was just how easy it is for that misinformation to be very deep. No, I did psychology at university as one of the streams, and did all the tests and thought, ooh, don't know what I'm dealing with here. What am I going on about? Also, just getting a degree proved to me that I was fine. I continued on, and I now have 3 degrees as well as a teaching diploma, so I've more than proved it to myself. But it can still just trap you in the funniest ways occasionally.
Let's talk about the teachers that were at school and under you when you were principal, and Shirley Bartz and those sorts of people. Do you want to talk about your team kind of your style of...
My style was very different from Betty's.
Yeah, let's go into that a bit.
You probably need to talk to them to get the real difference from it. I'm not an extrovert, and that makes a big difference. Betty's just a charismatic personality, which I'm not. And so it was really setting up and steadying the patterns through. I did inherit all of the teachers from her to begin with, I think. Yes, I would have. I think I did. Some of them... Betty had had a bad year the year before where some burnout was showing in her too, and so there'd been some coming and going and so on. And I didn't start at the beginning of the year, and she and I set the school year up together with the teachers and so on, and then I came in the June or July, I can't remember which, but somewhere around about then when the end of the semester at uni finished. So really there'd been an interim time, even though I hadn't been there, I'd been coming and going a bit. And I'd come through a lot of the university holidays in those intervening years, so I wasn't somebody who hadn't been there in the intervening years at all. So I did take over. I don't remember having any real difficulties with most of the staff. I probably had a few arguments to get authority into place, not bossiness. On the whole, I think they respected me as principal, with one probably rip-roaring difference. There was one person who, I don't know, I never did understand why I threatened her so much, but I did. And she continually misheard me when I'd ask for things. Looking back, maybe there were other ways to manage it, but I think I was just stunned that if I said something, she would take it personally, and I was talking to the whole staff. I think I instituted very much more regular staff meetings. I started demanding lesson plans from everybody. Some of the, you know, you come in brand new and you've got all the theories in your head. I certainly started to do that. I struggled to get some of them a lot of the time. Some of those teachers are still good friends of mine. I'd have to say Shirley Barth's kept me going. It's just so wonderful to have a good secretary who cuts things off at the post. By the time I got there, Betty had put an escape door into the office, so you could actually get away if somebody was coming in the front door you didn't want to see. She had been known to get out the window. That would have been past my capacity to do. But it was good to have that escape door. I don't suppose I used it very much, but it was nice to know it was there and you could get straight into the staff room from it.
Can we talk about Shirley Barts for a minute? Can you talk about what Shirley Barts was and what kind of support she gave you? Like, how important was Shirley Barts?
Shirley was very important because A, she knew everybody. B, she was very realistic about everything. She was totally loving towards the kids. She knew the kids, so she could, you know, nobody could pull the wool over her eyes very much. She was an efficient secretary. She was a great friend. She struggled to learn the new things that we needed to learn because there were some changes coming from Catholic education in those things. But she was out there, like so many people in that area, and she just said when she couldn't do it, and so we could work around that. She's the sort of backbone to a school that you always need.
Now, we might just revisit what you talked about earlier about, and which obviously comes from your experience and that you probably brought into your school about, age and related to education. Mm. But can you talk about that?
I don't know that it happened all that much at Sadler, to tell you the truth, but there's always a temptation for parents of intelligent kids to want to push them forward. And that was no less true for a lot of the children in Green Valley. Their parents really wanted them to do well. Certainly some of them more than others. Some took for granted that their children would follow the way they were following and so on. We had a great deal of hope for a lot of those children that they do extremely well, and they certainly had the intelligence to do so. So it was enriching the education experience so that they could find things. It was still only primary school, but just that. And then occasionally you'd find an intelligent kid that a parent, I've never really worked out this, and it'd be unfair to say it on a particular child, but there's an element of parental pride, I think, that wants to push a child beyond their capacity, beyond their age. And they can be very, very gifted. I can certainly think of a couple of parents there that I had an argument with, and one certainly didn't ever go to St. Therese because of it. They had very gifted kids, so they sent them to some of the state schools who would promote them or give them something much more enriching that we were able to. But it was just all the time saying, you know, there are other things in life besides academic. Your child needs to be able to relate to other kids. Your child needs to broaden the education base and not just be a fabulous mathematician or a fabulous something or other. So I suppose that just stood, I don't remember any great drama with it, but I just know it stood really there always at the bottom of my understanding. And when people were trying to enroll kids who were just on that awful borderline cut-off time, I would never encourage the ones who were just on the borderline to start, because I'd say, you know, another 6 months. So probably there were a lot more milder times that I just said, oh, look, if you're doubtful, let them have the extra year, or if you're doubtful, give some time to solidify.
So you said you were grounded, or you're on your feet when you hit the principal job. So those 10 years, like, so you were in the right plot, you were in the right space.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. How did you feel? Like, how was your journey over that 10-year period as a woman in terms of...
6 years I was principal.
Six years.
And,
you know, your own personal kind of growth as a result of being in this community, did it in... You know.
Being accepted in that community is one of the best gifts I've ever had in life, I think. It's probably the community, if I look back, that's broader than the religious community. It's probably the group, the thing that was most satisfying for me, because you were relating to people, all sorts of people. You weren't only the principal of the school, but you met them in the parish, you met them up the street. I can remember talking to your mother on the top of a escalator in the middle of Westfield. Just all those sort of things. It was your life that was it. And when I went back there years later, because I lived at Sadler again after I was teaching, and I was actually a social worker at Liverpool Hospital, the same thing was there. It was still that sense of, you might meet people around the Franklin's shelves, or you might meet them here. You were just part of them. There was just a sense of belonging, I think, as much as anything. That was very satisfying. Where I didn't think it through, and where my so-called groundedness probably didn't stretch, was I kept giving and giving and giving, and not necessarily remembering to keep the balance. And I think that Green Valley, Sadler, is a trap for the unwary in that respect, because the needs are always quite high and they're quite overt, and that's very satisfying if you come in as a giver. But it's you have to have even more maturity than I had, I think, not to get trapped there and to remember to take time for yourself. That makes sense? Yeah. It's so the burnout, which frightened me at the end of that 6 years, also made a lot of sense when I came to reflect on it afterwards. It was that sense of... I made a big mistake when I first went to Sadler in 74. I'd come from teaching at Barrowburn, and I knew the year six at Barrowburn very well because I taught them. And that's Rose Bay and the year six. So I decided to put them both together and have a shared thing. Stupid. The kids from Sadler, who were very confident young women, suddenly were not confident anymore. They were really quite put off. And the kids at Barrowburn, who loved me very dearly, were suddenly seeing me associated with these children from the outer western suburbs. And they didn't quite know how to take me at all. So what I realized myself was that I could live in both those places really comfortably, but I needed to build more bridges if I wanted to put them together. And I wasn't enough bridge for that, so I didn't try that experiment again. But it was a good experiment to have tried, because it actually just highlighted for me that to do some reflection. And I found working at Barrowburn very challenging, again in the principal role, but very challenging because the parents have all the same needs as the parents in Green Valley, or a great many of them, that you can't cover up with money, but they need to be covered up because you can't have them. And at Sadler, the parents have needs, and they come and say, "Sister, I've got a need. Can you help me?" So very different ball game to work with. Here you had to actually uncover the need before you could start to meet it. You couldn't meet it, even if you knew it was there, you couldn't meet it before you could uncover it, and they didn't want it uncovered. And these ones they said, I've got a need, can you help me? Much more satisfying working. And I knew that very early on. So that stood me in pretty good stead. But as I said, the second time round, yes, I kept wondering how Betty survived 13 years before she actually, well, she survived 10 or 11 or 12 anyhow, before she started to really fray at the edges. And I frayed after 6 or after 5. Mm.
So where did the fraying take you?
The fraying took me actually into... where did it take me? Well, it took me into just tiredness and knowing I needed some help. What I didn't realize that happened was that I hadn't lost my love of children, but it had lost its edge. And I didn't, even after a year of coming good and being quite capable of taking on another role and starting to do a whole lot of things, it was only about 3 years after I left Sadler that I saw a child in the street one day and my heart sang. I thought, it was like coming alive again in a way that I hadn't realized I'd gone dead. And so I think it probably took me into social work in the end, into honing the need to be able to offer a much more considered gift, I suppose, a much more trained gift. My definition of a social worker is just a trained self. Because all you really offer is yourself, but you've got a few edges of understanding around it. And I think that social work training certainly gave me much more capacity not to burn out and to look to my own needs and to keep the balance and not to go over the top and to keep things well supervised and all the things that weren't offered me as a teacher. And I may not have taken them if they were.
How old were you around this time?
When I was 40 when I finished up at Sadler.
Okay, so you're getting into your 40s. So, and you're social working?
No, I actually, 40 I left Sadler. I had a few years then. My mother, as I told you, died that year. I had the year off, the next year off, 41. My father was still alive, so for the next few years, I actually spent my time half and half. I spent half my week with my father. He was 85 when my mother died. And half the week working in Sydney, mostly at the provincial office, doing secretarial work for both Betty McMahon again, who was the provincial bursar, and for the provincial. So I was doing half and half for a few years until 1990. And during that time, to keep my head that I thought I didn't have earlier in my life, I'm occupied. I did a Master of Theology part-time. So that was, I was living at Sancta Sophia University College, so it seemed normal to do some study. So I finished that Master of Theology, and then Dad died early 1990, and I enrolled then into social work. So I graduated in social. I was able to do a social work degree in 2 years because I already had some psych and some other things behind me. So 1991 I studied, 92 I became a social worker, so I was 48, I suppose, somewhere like that.
Somewhere around my age.
Is that how you're old? How old you are? I must have been. So 98, I would have had to be. 44, no. Anyhow, in my 40s. So then I made another 30-day retreat, because the 10 years from when I had been professed to then had been years of complete turmoil for me. I'd had that time out for counselling. I'd done some study that had changed my whole way of being. I'd been burnt out. My mother had died. My father had died. I just thought that I needed to take hold of the life that was before I went forward into a new career. So I went to New Zealand and Mary Dapachee directed me through a 30-day retreat. And it was a really good thing for me to do in terms of just pulling together who I was and getting back in touch more deeply with God and so on. But it was not a good thing to do in terms of coming out as a new graduate social worker and looking for a job when I was already in my 40s and different from most new graduates. And so it took me about 4 months to get a job. And they were months of quite being really depressed because I was of a different age for writing CVs and things. I was still of the age that tended to be more humble about what you could do and not do. And I had a lot to learn in that 4 months. I was actually living here. And it was just awful. I went for every job, and I really didn't want a Centrelink or a Docs job. So I left them off the bottom, but I even got to applying for those. In the end, I was just desperate. I had a very mixed experience. I did find that people valued social workers a bit older, but then they didn't value them inexperienced. I really wanted to work in the community because community was who I was, but community wanted hospital experience before you went there. It was just one of those swings and roundabouts. So I finally got a job at Liverpool Hospital in oncology and palliative care, and I started there in late May. And the end of the following week, when I was going out to stay with one of my own sisters so she could make me some new clothes, she actually had a massive car accident and had a head injury, and so my life suddenly went into a very strange whirl of visiting her at Lidcombe, Westmead first and then finally at Lidcombe, for all over the next year. And that was a really hard ask for someone working with death every day of the week anyhow, and so on. So it was an interesting and tough learning experience. I was lucky, as so often happens, that I fell on my feet with the doctors I was working with and with the supervisor I had in the social work department. So there were all sorts of good things that happened. So I continued to work there and continued to keep a watching eye on Jill, thinking that she would die. And then finally she went to Lidcombe Brain Injury Unit and they started to work on her because they'd all thought she was going to die too. She's still alive. And so so I continued to work there for about 4 years. And towards the end of that time, I began to think that I had probably enough of oncology and palliative care. I liked it. That B, if I was going to continue my life in social work, I probably needed a mixed experience. And so I started to job hunt, and I got a job as the manager of the school age service in the Spastic Centre over at Wetherill Park. So I was still living at Sadler all that time. I'd moved from here out to Sadler when I was trying to manage Jill and all the other things. And I worked there for about 5 years. And then, still within the Spastic Centre, I became the rural regional manager. So I had a job at Allambie Heights for a couple of years. And then I left that quite unhappily. I had a clash of integrity, is how I usually say it. And then I job hunted again, and I got a further job in an aged care service, community aged care service, setting up a team on the Lower North Shore of Sydney. So that's when I moved to Mosman again. So I had about 15 years working as a social worker. All good experience, all different experience, working right across in a whole lot of variety of ways. Learning new skills. Discovering myself again as a manager, I think. Finding that my management skills could move out of a school and into a community aged care service or into a disability service. I knew nothing about disability. My learning curves were exactly perpendicular in all of those jobs. They'd been good years. And then I was asked to do the Director of Vocation Ministry for my order. And so I resigned that job, became an old age pensioner, and started to be the. I had a sabbatical, and then I'm still doing vocation ministry, which is meant to be my full time job, but at the moment seems to be my part time job, while provincial council is my full time job, just at the moment. So that's. Where did I get there? So in my 40s, yes, is when I really started to move into a different place in my life. Out of teaching, into social work. I'm quite sure I do social work with a teaching background. I think it shows. Out of straight social work into management within social work, just a variety of things.
How was it being in Sardinia when you were at Wetherill Park? Did you feel like poking your head in the school doors?
I was living on the property, so sometimes I did certainly poke my head in the school doors. And the Green Valley Pub did a fundraiser for me one Anzac Day and frightened one of my team, but not me. She couldn't believe I'd walk into the bar of the Green Valley Pub looking for the publican. At that stage, it was somebody we knew well, so there we are. It was good, and we had. I worked a little in the adult team as well, and there were. We had a house in Busby, I think it was, where some of the people lived, and so it. You know, the whole area was natural, and to me, it was quite easy. The funniest thing was the day my new manager came to drop off the job description or something after she'd offered me the job. She came to drop something off anyhow, just as some wretched kid had stolen the fire hydrants out of the school. I've forgotten. I think they were put out to clear or something. Anyhow, some kid took off with one across the road, and I came flying out the door, chasing him. Nancy screeched. She was still principal, and she grabbed the car to chase him, and I chased him straight across behind the church, and she came around the outside, and my poor new boss just. I think she wondered what on earth she was getting. This woman rocketed out of the convent door and said, "Oh, it's very nice to meet you. Quick, just hang on there till I go and grab that kid who's got our fire extinguisher." Came back with a fire extinguisher anyhow. So she, I don't know what she thought she was going to get. So I think living in Green Valley again was, it's just nice to be in a place that's home.
What did it give you? Well, I think you've gone over a bit of that. What did you take from Green Valley into your future? Did it change you?
Oh, it could not have changed me. So I don't know how you put this, and it's an image more than anything, but somewhere in the depth of me are the people of Green Valley. I am who I am. Because of their acceptance of me, because of their friendship, because of their needs sometimes of me, because of their courage, I think. Yes, because of their really deep appreciation of what we as a religious order gave, not just me, but we. I think that'd be what it is. It's hard to define because it's just a part of who I am.
It's so interesting, isn't it, when you think about how the community was projected through the media, and to hear what you're saying coming out of your mouth,
it's the people I know and love, and it's the ones who were difficult. I mean, we had one family that were extraordinarily difficult, and one kid I was absolutely determined to classroom train. I nearly lost all my team over it, my staff. But his father had lived in a paddock with a horse. He was quite odd. And until this child was 5, he could do no wrong. And once he was 5, he could do no right. And he had lived in the principal's office, I think, in the school before he came to us. Anyhow, between us, we tried. That's all I can say. And I can remember one day, I just said he had to do his work before he went home. I was principal, not teacher, but I stood in the doorway of the classroom and said there was. I had to fill in that afternoon. He'd done nothing, so I said there wasn't a lot of work to do. It was to be done before he went home. So he stood at the back of the classroom abusing me, and I stood in the doorway. And you may remember that all the classes interlink. And he said he wasn't going to do it, and I said he was going to do it, because if he didn't do it, then he didn't have a place in the school. So he picked up, he threw the book, the desk, the chair, the pencil, the ruler, everything he could find at me, and then ducked out the back door and took off home. So I picked up the phone to his mother and I said, this is the situation. I was teaching the class myself. There was very little to do. I insisted he do it. He either comes back and does it or he doesn't come to school tomorrow. He was back in 5 minutes. He did the work in 20. And then he went home. But it was that consistency of being able to work. He went to jail. He came to visit me when I was working at the hospital. I was very glad I was leaving very soon because he'd got into astral travel. And he just thought that it would be really good for him to come and teach all my patients astral travel. So at least I had enough. Sarah's very sad. I was actually leaving the job, so I couldn't do it. And the next time I met him was in one of our community services from the Spastic Center, where he was again doing community service. And when I walked in, he just went, whoops. Came over in a quiet moment when no one was looking, and he said, I'll have to call you Diana here. I said, yes, it'll be a help if you do. And he said, I just had to break his brother's arm. He just wouldn't do what I told him, and I had to break his arm. I said, you never have to break anyone's arm, and I'm really sad to see you doing community service again. But just do it well and don't break it next time. Find something else to do. And I thought, it's a small world. You meet these people. Whether I heard that he died or his brother died, but anyhow, you just hear, you know, wafts, and that's what I mean by them still being inside you. It's not just the stalwart families of the parish. It's the people who tried and struggled, and people who you go to their mother's funeral and they tease you about green cards, and they're perfectly stable adults, and they only had green cards because I just had a whole lot of cards that were green and I needed some way to connect to the parents when they were mucking up so badly. So we instituted green cards during my time. And he said he still had it, 25. I said to him, do you think he'd like to give it back so that we could get rid of the evidence? And he said, no way, he's going to frame it for life. But that sort of relationship you can have with kids you taught is just lovely. Mm-hmm.
So how did you keep, let's talk about your faith. I mean, that's all come through throughout this, but how do you keep the faith, Diana? How do you...
I don't know whether I keep the faith, Therese, or it keeps me, to tell you the truth. I think it was a gift at birth. I have a couple of images that stand me in awfully good stead. One of them I've stolen from Hildegard of Bingen, who's a European mystic. She talked about being a feather on the breath of God. And I think that is an image that I hold on to quite a lot. It's pretty hard to be much a feather and you find yourself here, there and everywhere else. It's an image that God teases me with, I have to say. When I went for an interview for one of the jobs that I really, really wanted, I was early, as I always am, and I sat in a bus shelter around the corner just because it was that sort of day, and past my eye level wafted a feather. Just little things happen. I go along and I might be feeling a bit down, and forever will I find a feather at my feet. So there's a sort of give and take in relationship with God on that particular one. I pray, obviously. I wouldn't say prayers very often, very scintillating, but I give the time to God for that. I trust that God will lead me wherever I need to be. I don't always understand where that is, but I do try to follow where it seems to be leading. I think God can write very straight with some pretty crooked lines, and he can make up the messes and do that. So I think faith was a gift in its first instance, and I think living in faith takes a bit of loyalty and consistency and coming back when you get lost, and sometimes walking through the dark and wondering what it's all about. But at the end of the day, it's finding God wherever it is. I can give you an example. That elder sister of mine did actually leave the order, and she died a few years ago from breast cancer.
Just repeat that just so that I don't have to cut into that.
My elder sister, the one who left the order, died a few years ago from breast cancer, and she decided to be buried back in that small town where we were all born. And she also decided to be buried with no mass and no priest. And so that was fine. So we all tootled out there to the red clay of our childhood, and we buried her exactly the way she wanted to be buried. And I read a poem by her graveside that has a line in it that says something like, "And a rainbow tells us you've arrived home." And I went back to see her grave again before we left to come back to Sydney. But all those who left immediately from the afternoon tea ran into a double rainbow. And we didn't see it. We just did a little aquaplaning on the roads. So I had already decided, because she'd been one of our nuns, and I didn't particularly want them all to know that she'd decided to get buried without a mass or without anything else, I had decided to have a memorial mass for her at Mossman, where I was living, so that all the cousins that couldn't get there could come, and the family who couldn't get there could come, and the nuns who would like to come could come as well. So, but I had a sort of hesitation in my being that she wouldn't like it, although I thought maybe she'd just have to tolerate it. The morning after that mass, there was another rainbow. So it's those little touches that some people would just say, and that's fair too, or they're incidental events. But for me, they've got a pattern that moves through. And I don't think I'm blind or gooey-eyed about them. It just helps me keep moving in faith. I also had an image through many of those years that were tough, that I was hanging on by my eyelashes. With somebody of my size and my eyelashes, you know how hard I was hanging on. I wasn't even hanging on with my fingernails. But I realized at the end of that time that I wasn't doing any hanging on. I was being held. And that's fine. And I think there have been moments when I've discovered God's love in ways that I discovered once, that to be loved by somebody totally unconditionally is terribly hurtful. You just get so, that's such a gift when you don't deserve it, that it's overwhelming. So those moments keep me going through the harder times. Mm. So my faith underpins and calls and needs lots of nourishment, but it's deep and it's real. Mm.